Mics are live.
We are now reconvened for the administrative portion of the meeting. We have one item on consent. I move approval.
Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Say nay. Motion is approved.
Okay, then.
Who's being appointed? Do we know?
On the legal services.
Yeah, on the
It's Mitch and his group. Correct. Correct. I don't know. We have sent an information request out. We have, I believe we have received the list of contacts for township, counties, and cities, and so we sent a notification of the filing to those entities, and so we're moving along. I think.
I wasn't on.
There's a certain amount of information we need right away to continue, and we're waiting for that.
Sounds good. Thanks, Pat.
Okay. And then moving into discussion matters. The first is, I just want to get a feel from both of you on Northern States Power. Would you like to have another work session? Do you?
I don't think I need one.
I don't need one.
Okay. And I think we can move forward with preparing an order and hopefully coming to a resolution on that. The second is the prime farmland rulemaking. Jack.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I pass out a little bit of paperwork for all of you to look at. I know we had some discussion about conducting a rulemaking possibly on the next agenda, and I guess start working on that paperwork. I outlined a couple things in here. You can see I took out the exclusion area, the prime farmland from the exclusion area. On page 2, I also changed after a little bit of an issue recently about where a turbine has to be set back from a transmission line. I just add a little change in there from the right-of-way. I'm not sure if that was what we had spoken about, but I believe that's what I recall. And I put the prime farmland from, I moved it from the exclusion area to an avoidance area on page 3.
So, Jack, before we move to page 3?
Sure.
Yeah, I think it's just common sense, and it shouldn't be that hard to interpret that it's from the closest, most edge of the right-of-way.
Mr. Chair, in the last time that we spoke about this, actually, in that proceeding, there was some confusion whether it was the right-of-way or the actual outside edge of the transmission line itself. And so that's where the ambiguity was. And so this actually clarifies that it was at the right-of-way, at the outside right-of-way, because actually in that proceeding we allowed it to be the edge is where we were kind of discussing that.
The edge of the power line.
The edge of the actual outside of the transmission line where they were measuring from the center line. And so I wasn't sure if that's of the edge of the right-of-way is where you guys intended to have this and where how this was supposed to be interpreted, so I just added that in after our previous discussion.
Yeah, and again, I would find it very hard to believe that someone wouldn't interpret that as the closest, most edge of the right-of-way, because there's two edges to a right-of-way. There's a center line on a right-of-way. Would anyone ever come back ever and say, well, we're 10 feet inside the edge of the right-of-way, but based on the center line or based on the other edge of the right-of-way, we're in compliance?
I think in the previous case, they weren't talking about which edge of the transmission right of way it was. It was from the actual, whether it was the edge of the transmission line, the nearest edge of the transmission line, or the edge of the right of way. So I agree with you that probably there wouldn't be confusion of whether it's the center line or inside edge. I don't think that is as much of a concern, but this actually steps it out a little bit further from the edge of the transmission line to the near right-of-way edge. And I believe that's what I recall from the discussions, that there, and someone would like some sort of clarification with regards to that. I may have misinterpreted that as well.
No, you didn't misinterpret it. It just begged the question in my mind that, okay, this misinterpretation, how crystal clear do we have to make it that it's the closest most edge of the right-of-way? And if edge of right-of-way suffices, I'm absolutely fine with it.
Oh, I see. So you're saying maybe we should clarify to say the closest edge of the right-of-way.
There's two edges to a right-of-way. And again, I think it's common sense that, no, it's the closest most edge, but, you know, there was already confusion in terms of how to interpret that. Should we be doubly careful on these, just say closest most edge of it, of the right of it.
Sure.
If that's the right way to say it.
We certainly can make that change. We'd probably have to change it for the additional ones in there, because I know there's the other references to the right of way. But even if we just put it forward as it is right now, this language can change to our final draft. This is just the notice of this. This is the notice of our intent to change these areas of rule, and then we could broaden the discussion a little bit. The one other item, too, I just wanted to bring to the commissioner's attention is there's the recent, I think, House Bill 1383, and that currently is discussing prime farmland as an exclusion area, and they also discuss irrigated land as well, and I wasn't sure if that's something that you would like to have discussion with this rulemaking as well for the siting of energy conversion facilities and removing that from the exclusion area.
What, irrigated land? No,
I
boy, irrigated land, it gets complicated when you start looking at pipelines and stuff.
Commissioner, sorry.
My opinion is, to the extent that times change and we no longer, or at least some people are no longer looking at maintaining prime farmland as a role of the state, if the landowners of the prime farmland want to do something different than farming it, then if that's fine, then I don't see why irrigated land would be any different either. And so I think they go together. And from all we're hearing, I think most people would like it not to be an exclusion area, and I'm fine with listening to the testimony and seeing it. Maybe we'll find there is a reason to keep both an exclusion area or make them avoidance areas or not be concerned with them any more than any other farmland in the state. But I think they go together. If we need to protect irrigated land, I think we need to protect prime farmland. And I hadn't thought about it before, but I'm glad it was brought up, because I think we should include both of them in a rulemaking and get some information and decide what people want to do.
Sure. And Commissioner Fedorchak, this is only for the energy conversion facilities and not for the transmission siting. If I recall correctly. So, yeah, and that's 6906-0801. So if you look further down, I didn't highlight that. I don't think the legislation that is being proposed also, I don't think they're referencing transmission as well.
Because I hadn't actually, the only time I'd ever thought about irrigated land being something to avoid was in the case of pipelines.
Right.
And again, I'm surprised that I didn't think of this before. But, you know, in the case that brought up our discussion on prime farmland, so if a quarter or two of that was irrigated, would we be looking at that any different? They would want to change it to a
transmission facility. I guess you're looking transmission at the value of the land, and I'm looking at it from a safety standpoint. If there's an oil spill on a pipeline, it gets exacerbated if that land is but my issues aren't even to play here because it's not that section of law. So.
Right. The irrigated property and irrigated land would be under an avoidance area right currently under the transmission sign criteria. So I guess just to wrap this up, is the commission comfortable with my adding irrigated land possibly to the notice of proposed rulemaking? And I'm going to attempt to try to get all the paperwork together for the next agenda to try to get this moving along.
Okay. I am.
All right. I am.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Next up, Stacy, 2018 year-end consumer affairs report.
So you guys should all have a copy of this. This is the year-end report that you guys have copies of it, right?
I don't. I mean, you emailed me one, but I don't have a printout.
Okay.
I would help with technology. Do have it, Stacy.
Did you email it this morning?
It was supposed to be in the system under the documentation. If you want to skip and go to another one, and we'll get copies made for you because you really should have it in front of you. Okay, apologize for that.
I was surprised when I looked in my folder and didn't see it. I thought, oh, she must have copies.
I submitted it. I maybe don't understand the process correctly. We'll get copies made if you want to go on to the next one and come back.
Okay, then we will go to Abandoned Mine Land Program Reauthorization. BUD. Okay.
I think you have the letter.
I do have that letter.
Okay, and as we had discussed before, a letter to the governor and congressional delegation urging support for reauthorization of the AML program with the caveat that the money be spent for only high-priority AML sites, and I think we've added that language in there. We broke it down to a letter and then an accompanying fact sheet that kind of highlights the program and then the accomplishments that we've had here in the state. So I guess open for discussion. And Randy pointed out one item on the fact sheet, the second example should be broken into two examples. Actually, it looks like we just missed a page or a break there.
I think it's great. I like how you simplified the letter and took out all the regulatory language and citing of the federal code, et cetera. So I think it reads really nicely. I would just maybe bold. I know you've got that first, the sentence in the first paragraph, but the last sentence in the third paragraph.
Which one?
The last sentence in the third paragraph. Without federal AML funding, the state or private landowners will bear the cost of roads, buildings, and residential areas damaged by underground mine collapse.
Okay.
And then, let's see here. Mm-hmm. Are you going to have it back-to-back, or is that just for us? You'll have it as an attachment.
As an attachment.
I would make it a little bigger print.
Yeah, we can fill the page and
Yep. Good. But content-wise, it looks great.
And I had the original draft. We had Stacy review it, and I'll have her review this again before we bring it in for signature.
I don't have any issues with it.
I don't either.
Okay. So I guess we would bring it for the next meeting for signature then. And
I think you could bring it around. Anytime. Finish it up the front, and then just we can sign it. I don't think we need to vote on it.
I don't think we need to wait 2 weeks with it.
Okay.
I mean,
we could just circulate it for signature the next week or so here. Okay.
I think there's really a thing to vote on with it.
We haven't voted on letters in the past.
Okay. And you'll circulate that. We'll get signatures on it. Then next, Stacy, are you ready, or do you want us to circle T at the end?
Talk to Dean. He knows how it works because his letter was in our folder.
I was going to say, I totally failed.
Okay, so we actually have 5 years to compare now, so that's kind of nice. We get to look at kind of a five-year average, but the front sheet on the report is the summary. So everything in the back for data is summarized on the front, and once again, you can see the 5 years that I've been compiling it for you. Overall, so the total number of contacts received in the system was 491, which it's been going down a little bit each year. The only thing I could really pick out was we didn't have any big, huge cases that had huge numbers of public input. Like some of those, you can see they were driven by big cases, such as Dakota Access. And the first year was really skewed by an online petition where we had almost 400 contacts about railroad safety. So some of those years had some big public input cases. So other than that, I think it was pretty average if you look through the categories as to the number of contacts that we received in each category. And then, yeah, go ahead.
161 in electric, that seems pretty high. Like, it's the highest since we've
yep,
been here.
It was... public input, so we had 79 just for the Emmons-Logan Wind Project. So that was a big one.
Lighting is captured there then.
Yep. So this includes complaints, public input, and quick referrals. The first chart is everything. Mm-hmm. So those were wind. Yeah, all of the wind cases fall underneath there as far as public input. The Otter Tail Electric rate case had some. The NSP wind ADP case had some. So it was all public input related to electric cases that drove that one up. But the big one was Emmons Logan Wind had 79.
It's interesting that.
They had that nice little postcard that they developed for everyone to send to us.
Right. So there's 79 postcards, essentially.
Yeah. Yep. And then the second box on the bottom of the page only breaks out complaints for our regulated companies. So this does not include public input for cases, just complaints filed. And as you can see, they were all about what you would expect, with the exception of CenturyLink cases actually being down significantly this year.
Oh, that's the first time they haven't been the highest.
Yes, they did drop. They did drop significantly. I can guess at a number of reasons for that, but I don't know specifically. But their cases were down. MDU, Excel, and Otter Tail were all very slightly a little higher than last year, but well within the five-year average of where they normally stand. So nothing surprising there.
So if you were to, not to put you on the spot, but if you were to guess on the CenturyLink, I mean, what I'd like to say is the work that we required them through that agreement to do has made an impact and has
yes,
helped.
Yes, I would agree
not
with that.
Not that people just have given up.
I think it's a mixture, but yes, the communities in the western part of the state that were part of that formal complaint, I don't hear from them anymore now that the work has been done. So I do think that some of those problem areas were fixed by the upgrades that CenturyLink did in those areas. I know some other areas out there that were problem areas, CenturyLink actually gave those territories up, and a co-op came in and took them over, so I don't hear from them anymore. And then I do know some areas, in the western part.
Was that way northwest up by Alexander?
Yeah, it was, I'd have to look up what community it was, but they actually gave up a couple small territories. And then I do know some areas that have more competition now. There's been some other companies moving in, so in some cases I think some people maybe have found. But the main problem areas that we had 2-3 years ago out west have gone away since the work that CenturyLink did out there.
So my worst case scenario would be that customers just gave up calling because they just didn't get any resolution, didn't feel like anything was ever going to change. But it sounds like
there's been a lot of different options for the decrease or reasons for that decrease, a lot of them very positive in terms of customers having different options for service or CenturyLink addressing their service issues.
That's my feeling, yes. Good. If people aren't reaching out to us, then obviously I wouldn't know that.
Right.
But if people are frustrated enough, they reach out to us, whether they think it's going to help or not. They usually let us know what's going on. So
I think when you look at the data and the trend line from that data, it's really, it basically dropped about 60% from 50 to 60%. It was very consistent for 4 years, much higher, and it dropped significantly. So
yeah.
I don't think it would suggest, resignation on the part of customers by any stretch, but rather improvement.
Improvement in the big problem areas that we were seeing a couple of years ago, yeah. Those really, really rural areas out west that we were seeing the big outages in that didn't occur this year at least.
Well,
so
significantly better, as always.
Yeah, we'll hopefully it continues. And I won't dig into the rest of it unless you guys have questions, and you can always come back to me after you have a chance to look through it. But the paperwork behind that then is the actual data pulled from the system. The first section breaks out every single contact that we received by subject. So you'll see all of the, AML, license, rail, and the general categories that they fall under. And then the second section takes just the PUD complaints and breaks them out by company. So that's where you can see what kind of MDU complaints, Excel complaints, Otter Tail complaints. And then the third section is the quick referrals. It just shows other contacts that we received and referred off to other agencies or just provided information regarding.
Say, Stacy, if we're looking ahead a little bit on 2018, do you envision or are you already seeing an uptick on the grain warehouse, grain buyer as a result, or is Conrad tracking those here as well?
It's the same system. I don't directly take them, but if he puts them in the system, they're here.
I was just thinking about that. In the time period, in about 2 weeks, I received about 150 phone calls for that in November. So, and I have detailed records of those, but I did not get them entered into the public system on that.
Is that a track we should probably loop in? Because I don't know. This is a great snapshot for us to keep an eye on public concerns. But it's only as effective as, Stacy's diligent about doing it, but I'm not sure that other staff know. Maybe they don't know how, or maybe it's not part of the routine, but it would be helpful to loop that other staff in so that we know that it's complete.
Well, and as part of our case management update, we're also doing a new system.
Be cool if wherever you're tracking them, it sounds like you're tracking them somewhere.
Yeah, I've got notes written down of every conversation I've had.
So it's handwritten. It's not on a system at all.
No, it was a very busy time, we'll say, and that was the most efficient use of time to get the information documented.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So we'll probably have to go back
and
those.
I have transitioned some of them too. Electronic into a Word document too, just so that I've got them and they're a little more clearly written instead of in just kind of my chicken scratch. So.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's time. It's time consuming to keep records for sure. So however we can set it up so it's easiest would be, I think, helpful.
That's what we're attempting to do.
Yep. So this really should include maybe, I don't know how you guys feel about it, but if Conrad had 102 calls in November 2018 for Grain Warehouse, I would almost say we should add those in here.
We certainly could.
I'll go through my notes and get the exact number to Stacy for an addition into her report then.
Yeah.
I'll follow up with her.
Yeah, I agree.
And then I don't know how far back your notes go, but if your calls probably aren't being tracked you know, from 2017, 16, 15 either. But, I mean, maybe we can just make a clean break moving forward or something. Try to be intentional about those.
Well, and the idea behind the system is that everything we, every time we have a public contact, it should go in the system.
Mm-hmm.
I know that's hit and miss depending on division.
It does become particularly helpful in legislative years where we have a case to make for here's what we're hearing from folks.
Commissioner Fedorchak, I do want to add that other than for the insolvency action that we're working on, my notes are in the public system.
Oh,
the
they
contact
are.
System.
Okay.
Yes, it's just that
so
during that
part of your time, it's part of your routine. You just haven't had it. You didn't have a chance to do it then.
Correct.
Okay,
yep. So that does include those other contacts.
So then
I
it shows
had.
An even more dramatic jump, 102 from 2 in 2017.
Okay.
This is great, Stacy. I always appreciate having a chance to look at this stuff, and I missed our conversations when I wasn't the portfolio holder. So
yeah, we'll have to get
that
set up again.
Yeah.
Are there any other questions about the report first before I have?
Not for me.
And we'll make that update, and I can send out a new version. One thing that I had thought about in the past is sending you guys a weekly summary of everything that I took for that week, just to give you more of a feeling as to what's going on. Maybe weekly is too much, maybe 2 weeks, but I was kind of wondering what your guys' feelings were about getting more frequent updates from me just about what I'm seeing. It could be just a quick email saying, I had 2 MDU complaints this week about billing issues, and that's all it says, but I don't know if that's helpful or not, or whether you guys feel like you get enough information from me.
I'll say I look forward to these, and you know what we're doing is good and useful. And then sometimes when there's some case, I kind of, you know, how many complaints are we getting about this? But I do think I would like having something more often. I think weekly would probably start to seem like something that you just click away and then probably get in a routine of not looking at them.
Okay.
I think every 2 weeks or even monthly would be about one of those two would be a time frequency that I would find most useful. I don't know about the others.
For me, I think the biggest thing would be knowing when there's a spike.
Yeah, and I usually do let you know when there's something unusual going on.
Right. But I also like, I mean, I always hate to see something that is time-consuming to do.
It shouldn't take too much time, no. Like I said, we can run reports out of the system anyway, just like this. So if you guys want monthly or bi-weekly or whatever.
Yeah, monthly.
Just a monthly.
Be. And then, you know, like you mentioned, if there's a spike in something.
Yep. And if you see something on the report then that you want more details about, then I can follow up and give you the details into what went on with that complaint.
Because Brian makes a good point. I don't want to see this become a whole bunch of extra time and work for you.
Yeah. No, I was thinking like MDU, 10 complaints, 3 about billing, 2 about an outage, and that's it. And then if you want to know more about why there were those 2 outages, then you can let me know, and I can pull up the actual case details and let you know at that point. Does that sound good? Okay. All right.
All right.
Thanks, Stacy.
Yep.
Oh, and then a news release on this?
Oh, yes. Yes. Yes.
Just
let's
to be
get
consistent.
Let's get the numbers updated where we want them, and then we can.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Jerry, you are up next on...
I had these 5 rider cases that are, the notice period's up on them. They're 3 MDU cases, transmission rider, generation rider, and renewable rider, and 2 NSP cases, the transmission rider and renewable rider. And the question is, do you want to have a work set or a informal hearing on them? Have the company come in and explain them to you, or do you want it on some of them, or all of them, or none of them?
Might be helpful to have a informal with MDU on all three, and informal with NSP on both of those.
Okay.
I looked at them quite a while ago, so I'm not really remembering which ones are increases or decreases. It seems like there was a combination, if I recall.
Most of them were decreases.
Okay. Well, the decreases probably aren't a big concern.
As long as we'd be having an informal, maybe we'd just go through them and
we can run.
Highlight it.
Yeah, they could. If they're coming in, I thought they could probably talk about all three of them.
Now, technically, we're talking about five informals, but three would be grouped concurrently, correct?
Yeah.
And two would be concurrent of one another, even though it would show up as five.
So if we want to
bunch
do
them, right?
Yep.
That's a technical term.
Yep, bunch them up. So if we wanted to do that, we should probably just move this down to scheduling.
Okay.
No, I agree. As long as we would have them in anyway, even though there are some decreases, having them reiterate, it might be short, probably be very short and sweet on those. But
I guess my point is, if they're all, maybe we don't even need the informals if they're not. I'd have to review them more closely to see if there it rises the level of needing one if they're mostly decreases. But
yeah, we used to want to do them all the time on the transmission riders so they could describe projects for you. And so that was kind of the reason why I don't know if we wanted to continue that policy, or it wasn't really a policy, it was just how we were doing it.
Yeah. And there's a lot of stuff that goes into the riders, so I guess it's not a bad idea to get an update on.
Well, I asked the question because when I was talking with Jerry about it, I asked the question of when's the last time we had one of these, and then he reminded me that so many of these have been rolling into rate cases.
They file them every year, so I'm not sure if we did informals on all of them or some of them last year.
I don't recall either. Well, let's just do it.
Or maybe
Pat, see how
maybe
we like
you
it.
Told me some of them were getting mask. I think, I'm probably confusing Jerry. Pat, I think you're the one who mentioned that.
I did look at the past cases on the riders, and more than half of the time we did informals. I'd say like 60%, 60 to 70% of the time we would do informal hearings on the riders.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay.
All right, scheduling.
Okay, then next, Conrad, medical marijuana scales on the weights and measures side.
Almost the afternoon. Good morning, commissioners. Wanted to bring up our discussion a little bit and to see if there's any direction that the commission would like the program to proceed in as it relates to medical marijuana scales, or if you feel we need to have an additional work session to go over what the plans are. The reason that I wanted to bring it up now is that we did make reference to it in our budget testimony in the appendix, more of the additional information section that was presented to the Senate. And so I wanted to take this opportunity to see if we had a direction on if the commission wants to pursue going through testing and approving these scales, or if we still had some work to do on that. And just kind of get a general update on that. I know we're all very busy, but I didn't want this to hang out there for too much longer.
My thought is our job is to test scales and approve scales and not get caught up in terms of the substance. And we had a conversation about whether or not the contamination issue was a problem both with our equipment and then making sure that the facility, that we're not bringing anything, a contaminant into the facility. And from what I understand, that is not a significant concern.
That's correct. Working and talking with the Department of Health, you know, they're taking preventative measures to minimize any contamination to the facility. But following their entry guidelines and the company's protocols with the Department of Health escort we would not be taking any additional risk or a risk of contamination at that point, given the facility is the one that establishes their standard operating procedures on how visitors enter. And then in addition, they've worked on those with the Department of Health as well. So most likely the workload, I mean, it's two facilities in the state, as we've talked about, with 3 to 4 potential scales at each one, only in the laboratory or the packaging area, not in any of their production area. So everything would be limited to that one area there. I still stand by the fact that we would establish procedures that scales would be cleaned in the presence of our inspector to minimize any type of transfer of residue from the scale to our weights, in addition to ensuring that our weights are cleaned before and after any of that action occurs. But that's the way I view it, but this is something I know is definitely for discussion, or if this is up to, we need to have additional discussion, additional work session, we can more than willing to get that scheduled as well.
When are these facilities up and running or ready, close to? Or
I believe they're just about ready to get going.
Okay, and get so they're close to needing the certification.
Right, either that or if we have a different direction or a different.
I don't really see that we have a choice.
Well,
someone's got to certify the scales, and we're the certifiers.
I think we've kind of been through this, and I don't think my argument prevailed. I think it's important to keep at least pointing it out to the appropriators as part of our effort to make sure that they all remember that they have set all of our scale testing costs at amounts that are far less than the cost of providing the service. This one's going to be more. We don't drop by because we're in the neighborhood and it's right on the way, and so it doesn't cost us much more than $11. We make appointments at their convenience. I also worry some about the precedent it's setting. So does some gas station or some other entity that has measuring devices that we test decide they want their management team to be monitoring our tests? And so now instead of us doing them, when our people decide to inspect them, we need to call ahead and make appointments because you do it for them at the same price. So, but we've kind of been there and done that, but I think we need to keep pointing it out to the appropriators that it's making our job more expensive for the state taxpayers to do.
And I definitely don't disagree with those arguments. I think they're very valid, Commissioner. Just for peace of mind, I want to emphasize that the entity that we're going to work with scheduling as far as is with the North Dakota Department of Health. They don't make appointments with the facilities. They stop by. They're the regulatory agency of those facilities. They stop by and drop in unannounced, unexpected, as they need to. Our coordination is just working with the Department of Health program supervisor to have them as an escort to bring us into the facilities, which I think as a liability standpoint is a very good process still. So the entity that we're actually going to be doing the tests and approval for with the company will not know when our inspection is going to happen. It's just our coordination with the Department of Health as for an escort to go into the facility. But I do understand the concern, and that it does bring into the question as far as the additional requirements that we're doing, additional time that goes into it, and make sure we continue to note that and track that.
Right. And one thing, too, is we'll have a really good handle on the actual time it's going to take. And this process, you know, would start and then lead up to the next biennium, the next session. So, I just don't want to get caught up in the argument of whether or not you like this law in terms of the product being sold. If you don't like it, I think we've been tasked with making sure scales in the state are accurate and not looking at the products going across them.
Yep, I agree.
Okay, absolutely, and I will track that as we begin that process. Additionally, if the commission wishes, I can certainly, I would like to, you know, and I'll just send out a general, pass out information to the three of you as far as when we're expected to begin this, what steps we're taking, because part of it is I wanted to put together, you know, kind of a policy guideline for our inspectors that are going to undertake this as far as the things that we're going to expect and we're going to do as well. So
if it's packaged, I guess, it might not be all that different than any other scale in reality. So I think we need to, you know, go in cautiously, but not assuming that we have to take extreme measures if that's not. I mean, we're just not dealing with the part of the facility where they're packaging. Everything is in a package and ready to go. So.
That's correct, Commissioner. The scales we would be doing are their packaging scales as it stands, yeah. And not any of their production scales. None of those scales required to have a test and approval done on them.
So let's not be overly concerned about the contamination issue and, you know, go to extreme measures if that's not warranted. Once we get, you know, have more information experience.
Understood.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Conrad. The next, back to you, Mr. Hsu, on 2261, Senate Bill 2261.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did pass out the Senate Bill 2261. It wasn't on the calendar, but it came to our attention that it is up tomorrow at 9 a.m., I believe it is, in the Fort Lincoln room. And so we thought that would be a I think that warrants an opportunity to discuss this since this wasn't on our last in our last legislative meeting. What position the commission would like to take, if any, or any thoughts or concerns? Just to tee it off, I think traditionally commissions have been had an interest in, protecting their authority or preventing erosion of it. I think that this would probably does erode some of the authority and discretion to do certain things. The second thing I'd like to point out is number two. It's just kind of an odd thing to write in here to say that the applicant may not provide payment, because not only does it limit us, then it says you guys can't do anything. The applicant can't do anything as well underneath our chapter, which is just kind of an odd subsection altogether.
Would that prevent them from, under a lease agreement, paying somebody for an impact to their land? Because that happens quite regularly.
Commissioner Fedorchuk, that may be the case. It's hard for us to think of all the different ways this is happening because we really don't look at any of these things as it is
right.
Under our Siting Act. This is kind of something that does not belong, I believe, under the Siting Act, and it's kind of, and it seems related to other things that we generally aren't privy to.
Well, I think it's also related to misinformation that was widely distributed and assumed after the Fox sale hearing and issue. And that was just a lot of people are under the assumption that we did what was outlined here in number one, and we didn't. So
right. And I guess that would be a concern of mine. So to the extent that that may limit certain actions that the company may take sometimes to deal with landowners, not just even in the lease agreements, but also sometimes there are items that may affect their property. Even though this is directed towards environmental or wildlife impact, I know sometimes if things aren't right, the company will attempt to make things right outside of bringing it to a formal proceeding through having a monetary agreement with the landowner. The third item under sub three, I think it should be circled on the copy I sent out to you, and this it's the same under 4922 and 4922.1. These mirror each other, but the unless directed otherwise by the applicant language is also just kind of oddly placed as well, and I guess I would probably submit that maybe that should be removed. I'm not sure what that really has to do with the Siting Act or anything that we would do. We probably wouldn't. I'm not sure how they direct any of their funding, or it kind of goes along with sub two as well, where they, what, who, and where they provide money to.
Well, and that does seem to be counter to what I feel a lot of policymakers want to avoid, is that an applicant gives money to Ducks Unlimited or whatever. And under this, they could decide that they wanted to do that, and that would be allowed.
Seems like this, that sec, that piece of it allows exactly what caused most of the fuss.
Right. Exactly. Have you talked to these guys about this, Bill, Randy?
I will talk. When it comes to erosion of our authority, we have our authority because the legislature passed this section and told us to adopt exclusion and avoidance areas. So to me, if they want to say, by the way, but something is not one of those, or you can't use it in a certain way, I don't object to that.
Sure.
I do think we should point. I don't want them to be down in that committee room with the impression that out of thin air, this commission decided, let's make some avoidance and exclusion areas. This is what those things will mean, and this is the things that will be in each. So what I think we ought to be testifying to is, A, the legislature tasked us with creating a list of exclusion and avoidance areas. These were done, however, 30, 40 years ago, whatever it is, decades ago at least. And I don't know if we want to get into the prime farmland part, if that's any part of this, because it's really not. This had more to do with grassland, so it's not really probably the prime farmland part. But the fact of the matter is that we're currently working on a rulemaking to take some areas out of an exclusion area that for decades no one ever had an objection to until recently. Now we're working on a rulemaking to get information, what the thoughts are on. And then I do think that last part, to the extent that there are direct impacts, most of the objection that has come up about this section of law and our handling of it had to do with where indirect payments went to at the direction of the applicant. That was what caused this. And I think after hearing that, I would never be supportive of allowing something like that again. So taking that little section out, I think this would be a much better deal. But I think an explanation of how we got to this point almost eliminates the need for the bill. But if they still want it, I don't really object to it.
I tend to feel similarly to Randy about they're the policymakers, so they get to decide what we should and shouldn't be thinking about in terms of impacts. But the exclusion, I'm not sure if this bill is so much focused on exclusion and avoidance areas as indirect impacts, which that language is in law that we can consider, shall consider, whatever, direct and indirect impacts. And I feel like that's, I mean, the exclusion areas is also, and avoidance areas are also kind of woven in through the state species of concern, et cetera, which sort of triggers game and fish, et cetera, but it's really both. And I feel like this one is a little bit more focused on the indirect impacts, and so is Brandenburg's bill, which is going to be something we have to think about as well. And so then the question becomes, do we weigh in on whether there is value from our experience in having the freedom to consider indirect impacts? Is that something we should weigh in on or not? I've thought about it for days now, knowing this is coming up, and I still don't have a strong sense of where I am personally on whether it's appropriate for us to weigh in on indirect impacts.
I apologize. I kind of went off on a tangent there, and thanks for bringing me back. I was thinking more along the lines of the
prime farmland,
potential irrigation. You're right, and you're right. This is in the law. If they want to take it out, they probably don't need all this new language. Just take out indirect costs.
Yeah.
But is that a wise move? There are times when there may be indirect costs, and that's why there's public hearings for the public or other agencies to come and point those out to us.
Yeah. I mean, the...
Yeah, we have to be on point.
I don't know. Yeah, the indirect impact piece. The one piece that I do feel sort of needs to be clarified is what actually did happen from our standpoint. And Randy, you went through and explained that to one legislative committee. I have explained it over and over again to lots of different people, what actually happened in the Foxtail and how what we were asking of the company ultimately became what it did. And most people, when I explain it, are like, oh, wow, I really thought that you guys forced them to do that. And so the commission may not require an applicant to provide payment to any person. I mean, I feel like we don't. So I don't think we do that. So I don't know. It gets to the point of whether this is needed or not, but it doesn't really get into the indirect impacts, whether they want to get rid of indirect impacts or not. I kind of feel like that's up to the agencies, like all the different environmental groups, to make the case for us having them. Not necessarily that's our case to make.
Well, you know, a good example happened in a recent case. Maybe it's not that good of an example. Never mind.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean,
if we don't, otherwise. Maybe it's partially. If we wouldn't listen to Game and Fish or U.S. Fish and Wildlife in these cases that I think they're thinking of, then does that mean that we shouldn't have listened to the Ag Commissioner's office about a proper seed mix under solar panels?
Because that's an indirect impact. Probably too.
Yeah. So,
Commissioner Christman, to your point, and granted, I just glanced this through in about 15 minutes before adding to the agenda, finding out that it was going to be on tomorrow. It seems as if this, knowing what has transpired in the past, would be better if it was written actually towards the agency requesting those offsets and those costs to be paid by the company, because at no point in time have we ever ordered any group to do that. We've just incorporated into our findings once there was a voluntary agreement. Mm-hmm. And so if anything, I would say this is probably should be directed towards Game and Fish, or probably put somewhere under their the Century Code, saying that they can't request or shouldn't suggest that offset packages should be incorporated in the commission's decision-making.
Yeah, because if we don't get that testimony and or a settlement that we don't even have the details of, we don't order it.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, that could be. But that's really restricting the policy. It's providing some pretty prescriptive policy direction to Game and Fish that, I think it would be argued that's the governor's job.
Sure.
No, on the other hand, though, what if it wasn't Game and Fish? We have a public hearing. What if individuals come in and say there's a significant indirect impact? I can't think of an example of one, but this is going to do something to me. Then should we be able to have the company take care of that?
Say Jack on section 2. Does number 3 conflict with the second point they're making? Because number 2 says they cannot provide payment to any person for the mitigation, et cetera, et cetera. But then number 3 says any payment. Isn't 3 a moot point if they can't make a payment?
I think they probably justify that with the qualifier of any payment for the mitigation of any assessed adverse indirect environmental impact, as opposed to the
correct,
third one.
Not indirect.
Yeah, 3 on both sections,
sure,
is correct.
Sure. Yeah,
right.
Taking a pretty quick look at this. So.
But that's a huge thing on that one, because that, I mean, direct impacts we need to deal with. You know, they're eliminating something, and so to say that, and I actually don't, I think the Outdoor Heritage Fund is probably a good place to put those mm-hmm. in the future. If they want to direct that, I'm fine with it, but to have it unless the applicant wants yeah. to go elsewhere, I think that's going to get us in all kinds of hot water when those elsewheres are true. Things that are unpopular with the legislators.
And it may also be worth noting that relative to the other House bill that's out there related to indirect and direct impacts, this doesn't delete out our authority to look at direct and indirect impacts. That still is retained by the commission. That doesn't strike this out. It's just this appears to look more towards the payment, and we can still look at it in adverse indirect impacts. However, we just can't require anyone to be paid for it, or direct anyone to pay anybody for it.
So, my understanding then is, our decision would be we either just deny this thing, deny siting, because there's some indirect costs that we think are too much, or ignore them, but we wouldn't be able to say, well, you know, if you take care of these indirects, everything else is good.
Let me ask this question. I've been fairly quiet about this up here. I've had a lot of conversation about both bills.
Sure.
With different individuals. And you and I have talked about it, Jack. But how do we make the leap from mitigation, how does that ever equate to assessing a fee or a requirement that costs X amount to do something else with a completely different tract of land when minimizing impact to the environment, to me, is about constructing a facility or whatever's taking place, whether it's putting a pipeline in the least disruptive fashion, if there's nowhere else that can go and it can be legally sited and they meet the requirements. I still struggle with where the fee structure layers in on top of this, and that equates to mitigation. Is it that broad? And I suppose the answer is, maybe it is. It just, I'm just being honest. I just find that really problematic.
Doesn't that come from some of the wetland mitigation stuff that the federal government requires, though? Isn't that where that, like, if you impact this wetland, then you recreate a different wetland over here, and in order to do that, you have to cost X amount of money, and it goes to some fund. I feel like that's where that model came from. Randy, you might know more about
that. Well,
that's
exactly how it works with wetlands.
Yeah. And so I think that generally maybe that's how environmental groups work, in terms of if you're going to impact here, then you have to make good over here, and then we'll call it even. I'm not saying I agree with that. I just think that's where it comes from, that methodology. But if they... I mean, mitigation can take, you know, the first and the best way that I think has worked in this already is to mitigate the impacts that Game and Fish is concerned about, is that the companies are moving those structures up and not putting them on native prairie. And so that doesn't cost them anything directly to do that. You know, there's no payment to anybody. So if we didn't have indirect costs, indirect impacts to think about at all, or direct or indirect impacts, if that wasn't part of the equation, would companies do that? Probably not.
I think that's probably one of the goals here.
Right. So it almost, I mean, direct impacts are one thing. Indirect impacts are another thing that I know they're unpopular. I'm still wrestling with what's the justification for them. And how much does that tie to the purpose of siting as a whole? If you get rid of that, how much does it undermine the value of having a siting law if you take out that piece? And maybe not that much. I'm open to being influenced on that.
I think one of the key points for tomorrow is, though, that we've never assessed any.
Right.
We listen to the other agencies that have expertise, and in one case so far, the company, I can't speak to their mindset, but apparently felt that there must have been something of a case being made that there were some pretty significant impacts, because they reached a settlement agreement and presented it to us, and so that's what we had in front of us. They were supporting it. So was the Game and Fish, and was U.S. Fish and Wildlife too, I believe. Everyone was supportive of it, so we accepted it. We haven't assessed these, and
I think we also rightfully identified it as a voluntary agreement, which I think was key. But this is a discussion that could probably go on for a long time.
Well, so what do we do?
In terms of...
Well, I get back, although I was off point, but I think getting back onto the right points, I think perhaps Jack goes down or one of us and points out that we look at these because the legislature put it in the law that that's what we do, and we do not have scientists here on staff available for siting projects to make these evaluations that the legislature required, and so thus we have open hearings, and people with expertise or without expertise can come and testify. And so far, in a total of one case, well, there's other cases where people testified that there were impacts, but so far in one case, it seemed significant enough that the company chose to enter into a settlement. And most of the objection that we've heard so far was about where the money went. And so we've learned from that, this would prevent us from using what we learned from it.
Are you referring to Foxtel?
Right.
In terms of where the money... I think where the money went was caused some heartburn for some people. But I also think the company itself contended that the goalposts were moved on them in terms of the amount that would be palatable. And we weren't involved. I certainly wasn't in that room at the time, but they... there's no question that the company contends we entered into a voluntary agreement, and then the target was shifted, the goalposts removed on us, and I wasn't there. So I don't know if at the end of the day it was really where, you know, if they're entering into a voluntary agreement, well, they can do that at will. You know, if someone puts in builds a gas plant, and they want to do a voluntary type, enter into a voluntary agreement to build a playground or something in a town that's in proximity to the project, I think that's between industry and whomever they're working with at that point. But
although maybe so, not according to number two here, it says they can't pay it. So would number two here prevent something like is being done in Castleton with the voluntary payments to the school and whatever those other economic, I can't remember what all, they had kind of a list of things they were doing around the community?
Commissioner Chrisman, I believe that's directed towards environmental and wildlife impact. And so I would assume not, unless it's some sort of related to that. But that same thing could arise in any number of ways. It's hard to really foresee how they operate on the other side of these projects.
It doesn't prevent them from being a good corporate citizen, so to speak, if they so choose.
As long as it doesn't have to do with wildlife and an environment.
Can't be a good sort of corporate citizen there.
So if we, and I'm perfectly happy to go, or I have Jack go, I feel like there's going to be questions that come up about Foxtel, so putting Jack in the middle of that seems a little unfair. The position, if we agree on a position, which I think would be helpful if we all agree on a position, What would that position be? That we defer to the legislature on whether they want to include direct and indirect environmental impacts in the type of impacts we consider. We do it because it's in the law, because they've required up to this point. But then when it comes to payments, we don't like that last part of number three. And we have concerns about taking that, making that possible mitigation tool unavailable in all possible future cases, just because we can't envision all the cases that it might be used for, or what do you want to agree on?
I think you pretty well summarize my opinion on it when you say the last part of subsection three there. I'm assuming you mean the unless directed otherwise by the applicant, because
right.
I don't have any problem if they want to specify the Out There Heritage Fund for these things.
Yep.
Seems kind of detailed for legislation, but I don't object to it either.
Mm-hmm. And what about number two? What about eliminating the use of
I think it's a
payments.
Tool companies may want to use, but if that's what they want to do, I don't have real strong feelings. I think we're best as an information provider to clarify what's happened
yeah.
in the past that probably drew some of the attention to this, to at least make sure that they don't move forward with something without a full understanding of what has happened in the past
yeah.
under the existing law.
How about you, Brian?
I don't think the commission should be attaching price tags and directing where funds should go. If we do our job and we are choosing the least disruptive route in terms of, you know, taking environmental concerns into account, making sure that facilities aren't being built in exclusion areas, and we do all of those things, I think that is our job. I don't think then we become a broker and start trading this for that in terms of, okay, now there's a requirement in terms of a payment that has to be made that then goes to another group that's going to put something else in that's not even a part of the footprint, or potentially isn't a part of the footprint, whether it's a pipeline, whether it's an oil refinery, whether it's a wind farm, whether it's a gas plant. I just think that I've just never been able to draw the connection, and I wasn't a big, I thought, well, on the Foxtel situation, for example, I thought if the company is willing to enter into a voluntary arrangement and agreement, I thought that was great. But I certainly worry now that other companies have watched that whole process, and I would not be as eager, frankly, to do what I think you could deem as a nice move on a company's part. Are we disincenting them to even go there? Because now it almost seems like it's morphing into a penalty stroke in terms of increasing costs.
So where are you on number one and two? What is that? I understand you don't think we should do it, and we don't do it. But when it comes to this legislation, what do you think we should be saying about one and two? Anything?
When you look at this and then you compare it to what's the other one, 2346?
I can't recall the number off the top of my head, Commissioner. I apologize.
2346.
I think 2346 is green licensing.
Let's just focus on this one, though, because it's
hard to
compare them. We have to speak to this bill.
Yeah, but they're both in play from, you know, when I look at it. I think providing background is fine. We should always be prepared or willing to provide background. I've got to take another look at this because I think I understand what they're getting at, but I think it.
Okay, well, I will say that as a commission, we don't we feel it's up to the legislature to determine whether both direct and indirect impacts should be part of the siting consideration. We all agree on that?
Yeah.
And then do you also agree, Brian, on number on taking out unless directed otherwise by the applicant on that line 3 or line 16?
Well, the caveat to taking it out, of course, is now we're already saying that payments are in play, which I'm not wild about. So
that's for direct.
And I'll say we broker things in siting all the time.
Yeah,
and to me, one of the classic and nicest examples of it, that gas plant north of Kildare, we came in, we heard testimony, it was a problem. There's only one route in there for emergency services. And they didn't want the road construction tying up their farm scale during calf selling time. And it wasn't very long. The company said, well, we're not going to be doing road construction during calf selling time, by the way. And as a new part of our plan, we had forgot to mention, we were building an alternative route in there for emergency services. And, you know,
yeah.
That's kind of what happens in siting cases, that we find problems. And in most cases, the company chooses to want to
fix it.
Yeah, but guy needs an approach, and you're wrecking it. Yeah, we'll build him another one.
Yeah, and there's countless examples, I think, about the landowner and several of them on Dakota Access where the company's route was going right across stuff that they wanted to, and they weren't getting any resolution with the company directly, but they did once they came and spoke at the hearing. So, okay, well, I'm just going to focus on those two things, and then if they get into any other territory, I'll just say I'm speaking from my own perspective that it's not, that the commission hasn't considered that question as a whole, and I can't speak for all of us.
I would be good with that. I would be good with that, and I think you're the person for it. You've worked the most closely with it during Foxtail, so more so, although I do think I did a pretty good job in that one interview.
You did a very good job.
Commissioner Fedorchuk, just for one point of clarification, I just want to make sure that, because you said it's up to the legislature to determine whether we look at direct and indirect impacts, and completely agree, but I think the House bill, I think it's 1383 or something like that, really specifies direct and indirect impacts, and this one is really much more oriented towards the payments.
Right.
Okay, I just want to make sure that was clear.
It might not hurt to know when that language went in, the direct and indirect, and be able to point out, like, we've done close to $10 billion of energy siting in the last 6 years. That probably has been in there for decades.
Yeah.
All this has worked pretty
well. I can find that for you.
Okay, that'd be good.
Okay, so say that again. We're in agreement that, well, this is already a part of law anyway, taking into account direct and indirect impacts. So what's the switch?
This switches so that we're not allowed to require payments for indirect impacts to the wildlife or environment. And if there are any payments required for direct impacts, that they have to go to the Outdoor Heritage Fund, in short. That still doesn't mean we still would look with these changes at whether there are direct or indirect impacts during the siting process. That is still part of our statutory scheme.
So really what I would probably focus on saying is explaining how we do this, really, in that we don't, it's not the commission's practice, and I can't think of a single case that I've been involved in where we have directed a company to make payments. What we do is we talk through the issues that come up and direct companies to come back to us with information about how, if anything, are they going to do to mitigate the issues that were outlined? And they come up with their own solutions. So in this case, in this law, those solutions cannot include payments, is basically what this would be. But under no instance have we directed companies to make payments that I can think of.
Not direct payments, Commissioner.
Is
on my recollection, at least.
And even, I mean, when there's complaints and companies have to fix stuff, we do perhaps direct that, but that's after there's a complaint and going through. And usually even then, those are voluntary. The company decides, yeah, we'll do this, and, you know.
On the enforcement side, it would be getting them in compliance, fixing the issue, or penalizing them, which would not be a payment to anybody. That would just be an assessment of a fine.
Yeah. Okay. So I think it would be informational, Brian, mostly just explaining how we currently consider direct and indirect impacts and how the companies work to address those. And if they want to clarify in law that payments can't be part of the solution, that's up to them. But on number one, I mean, may not require, I do intend to clarify that we have not done that, required them to make payments.
And just for a little more clarity with that, Commissioner, with the Fox sale, for example, it was a finding, which means they are beholden to do that, but at no point did we urge or order them, but they are held to it unless the order is amended. Yeah. So they're constructed according to those findings.
Right, but even then, if they came back today and said, we object to this and want to, you know, we would reopen that or take whatever information they were giving us and consider it. And, I mean, they could have approached that so differently if they had wanted. All we asked for was a response to the questions that were laid out by and the concerns laid out by Game and Fish. That was what the request was at the hearing.
That's correct.
So, and we did that on every
case. The
other
thing we require is transparency. You know, they chose to do that.
Yep.
And just send the settlement in rather than discussing it with us. We tried to talk about what we were hearing down there, and we'll get back to you later.
Yeah. Okay.
It's interesting to see how this has shifted around with over the course of time since Foxtel. So, see where it lands.
I bet it'll continue shifting.
Okay, anything else on that?
Nothing for me.
Okay, then the last is going back to the Otter Tail order, Jerry. Lightning round, 10 seconds or less.
We're talking about the CIS system here. So they were unable to meet our January 1 implementation date because the system's not up, and they hope it'll be up February 1. At least say it will be, but, you know, I mean, wait and see what happens here. We had talked about, well, what shall we do? What's the best thing, best way to address this? And we came up with the idea that if we issue this notice of intent to amend an order, we don't have to do that later, but we can get into the comment period on this thing and get that out of the way. And then at that point, if we decide to amend the order, then we've got the notice done. And so that was kind of the way of... say that again?
Does the order have to be amended?
Well, that's, I don't think, totally decided yet either.
I think it is decided.
It is decided it needs to be amended?
Let me read the sentence from the order, and then that's the very first question. Does the order have to be amended? And the provision in the order says, Otter Tail shall file for commission approval an interim rate refund plan and compliance rate schedules consistent with this order, with compliance rates effective for service rendered on and after January 1, 2019. Mm-hmm. And so it was a consensus amongst staff. I guess maybe Jerry wasn't there, but it was a consensus that the order needed to be amended because they weren't going to be able to make the January 1st date.
Yeah. So
couldn't there have been, like, is it a tool that we have that companies notify us prior to that and we just say, all right, we take in the information and we make note of it in the file or something? I mean, why, if they aren't going to be able to make it do, and they're going to make it sooner than we can actually amend the order, why do we have to go through that? It just seems like,
that was my kind of thinking too, but I think it kind of got nixed in favor of amending the order.
One of the things that we consider, what we actually tried, was to have Otter Tail get in touch with the parties and come to a consent or come to an agreement or like a settlement almost, where they would say, "We waive the notice." Waive the notice of amending the order. You know, if we had that from all the parties, there was some thought that we could just amend the order then, without a notice. But we didn't. That didn't come back to us from Otter Tail. So we just thought we should go forward.
Maybe in the future we should have a little bit of language in the orders that say unless the commission is notified that this date needs to be extended or something, so we don't have to.
I think we could say, we could amend these orders to say something like, for service rendered no sooner than January 1st, for example.
Does that open the door for companies to then drag their feet?
And, you know, I saw a possibility of just having a motion on the agenda that says, I move the commission grant an extension on the implementation date and be done with it.
I think this helps push it, doesn't it, to February 1st implementation date. And but we've got to notice it. The notice has to, you know, hit the papers. It's got to, you know, satisfy the time requirement. And it's wonky, but I think it's the right thing to do for ratepayers to try to speed this thing up.
And we had other parties that had an interest in this case, too. And so putting out this notice also gives them a chance to comment or whatever they want to. You know, they don't get their due process violated.
Well, I guess it just seems like we're not really accomplishing a whole lot for those folks through this process. So would there be a way to... I like your idea, Jerry. The commission, you know, grants an extension. So maybe the language to be added is you give the deadline of January. I'm not talking about this case, but future cases.
Sure.
The commission, you know, you have to have these rates in place by January 1st, unless the company applies and the commission agrees to an extension. Or whatever, and then always they would know that's a deadline and they have to justify an extension, but we'd have the flexibility to do it without going through this notice period and everything else.
That's a good idea.
Yep.
I agree.
Okay, I don't need anything else on that.
Okay. We will now move to, that concludes the discussion matters. We'll move to scheduling. We have, I'm going to, two groups of informals, one for MDU, one for NSP.
Yeah, and so I got some possible dates here. For NSP, they suggested the 4th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 11th, 13th of February.
Can you give those dates again, Jerry?
4th, 6th, 7th, 8th. 11 or 13.
I don't think 11 or 13 work for you, do they, Julie?
We don't need any notice period.
No.
Oh, yeah, February. I'm in Nehruk.
D.C.
The 13th? Nehruk?
Yeah.
I'm actually coming back on the 12th, so.
Oh.
I leave on the 10th and come back on the 12th. Late.
4th, so. The 7th, and the 8th work for me if we wanted to. Do you have MDU's dates as well at the same time?
MDU just gave me dates they weren't available.
Are they pretty open?
They said they're not good the week of February 4th through the 8th.
Okay.
Or February 16th or the 20th and 21st.
What if we looked at them on, say, the 13th and then tried to do NSP the week of the 4th?
Do we have an informal schedule for that Wednesday of the 6th?
There is one on the books, but...
Is that just the holder?
Is that the holding spot?
It's just a hold at this point. Okay, perfect.
We like that?
Mm-hmm.
So we'll do NSP on the 6th. And you want MDU on the 13th?
Yeah, what time on the 13th works for...
Probably the afternoon in case you've got...
1:30?
What time? Will there still be committee hearings for Andy going on?
Yeah.
1:30?
I mean, all we can... One good thing about it's MDU, they're not flying home.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if we get called to our subcommittee, they're just going to have to understand we're going to go to the subcommittee.
Yeah.
So 1:30 then on the 6th and 1:30 on the 13th?
How about if we do one and then it's more likely that we're doing this while they're in floor session?
Sure.
Doesn't matter to me.
Either. So the 6th at 1:30? NSP likes that. They can get in and out the same day.
I think MDU will be able to be more flexible, so if we schedule it one, better chance that we don't have to move it.
Okay. All right.
And have we noticed our subcommittee meeting for this afternoon?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. All right. Is there anything else for the good of the order? We are adjourned.